Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. But you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Thanks for listening. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're staying safe. And we have Claude Jennings, award-winning Claude Jennings, doing all the important work here. And David zooming in from his favorite haunt. And we got a great twofer tonight on Chatter on Books. And in a little while, we're going to be talking to Nick Petrie about this great book, The Runaway, which everyone, New York Times, Lee Childs, everybody is raving about. It's fabulous. And in just a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to David Marinus, who has been on Chatter on Books before, last time in the ill-fated restaurant called Chatter, talking about his great book about his family. And we're going to talk to him about the Olympics, and we're going to talk to him about a book he's got coming up in August about Jim Thorpe. But first of all, David Aldridge, I got to run a couple things by you.
See what I did there? The runaway. See what I did there?
I was going to try to keep this a very non-sporty little exchange with you, but we got a tweet out from Jack. I'm going to withhold his last name.
Hello, Jack.
Can you ask David Aldridge about the stunning Cleveland Cavaliers? As Mr. Tony would say, attention must be paid. Love the pod. Thanks. We love you, Jack. Thank you. So we have a Cleveland Cavalier. Should I be paying attention?
Bark, seal, bark. Okay, here I go.
Roma sardine.
That's all right. They're a very, very big surprise in the league. No one expected them to be this good. Their rookie, Evan Mobley, has been phenomenal. He was picked third after two other people that most of the smart folks in the NBA believed would be great players, and he is going to be the runaway Rookie of the Year award winner. He's been phenomenal for them and fantastic. And they've had this incredible renaissance this year, not all because of him, but a good amount of it is because of him, because they've had a lot of injuries as well to two of their top three guards who are out for the season. In fact, they just traded one of them the other day for some help because they're so injured in the backcourt. But, you know, their coach has done a fantastic job, J.B. Bickerstaff. As I mentioned, they've got a special one in Evan Mobley, who's 7 foot, very mobile, agile forward, who can do a lot of things, impact a lot of winning. And he and Jared Allen, their center, have been terrific together.
Excellent. Very nicely done. Is it my imagination, or have there been a lot of injuries this season so far?
I wouldn't say any more than normal. There's been some bad ones, to be sure. But there were a lot of lower body injuries coming out of the lockout, out of the COVID delay a couple of years ago, because guys, you just can't. There's nothing you can do to simulate getting ready to play NBA basketball other than playing NBA basketball. Right. And so there were a lot of injuries. But no, not really. Not really.
Okay. Second quasi-sporty question. I was traveling a little bit last week. Mm-hmm. I was shocked how the new name for the Washington football team got so much coverage way beyond the DMV.
Well, this is good to know. It doesn't matter where you were. I mean, what did you see it on TV? Did you see it online? Where did you see it?
Yeah, all of the above. Mm-hmm. And people seem to think of it that it was a big deal and it somehow would make some difference. And I thought, oh, you crazy people living outside the DMV, nothing's going to change as long as we've got that owner. is there more to it than I saw? And then first thing.
I'm stuck here in DC, so I can't really speak to what the reception was outside. I certainly wondered and have gotten no explanation why they decided to reveal it on the Today Show. I can't imagine the Venn diagram of Today Show viewers and Washington Commanders fans is that large. Perhaps I'm wrong. I don't know what demographic they were trying to hit. I have no idea. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. And the rollout was not, from what I understand, because we were at the stadium, we weren't on watching the TV. The rollout wasn't all that effective or interesting. So
I have a conspiracy theory about that, why it was the Today Show, because that was so weird. And right now, David Marinus is going to join us in a couple minutes, folks. And right now he's going, this is why I leave Washington, D.C., because I hate it.
No, actually, I have some thoughts about this.
There's a certain person who in name only is the head of the Washington football team. And I think that person
he's longer, so.
I think that is exactly the demographic of the Today Show viewers. And I bet that person would love to have anything about the Washington football team, now the Commanders.
Well, I would. My only pushback on that is, and again, I may be way outdated on this, and please correct me, everyone, if I'm wrong.
Well,
the Today Show viewership is much more female than male, is it not? I mean, more women.
I was thinking of the spouse that allegedly is running the team.
Yeah, but I'm saying, if you are a team, for example, a football team, and the last year and a half you've been having to deal with this years long parade of women saying this is the most toxic, most sexist, most horrible place I've ever worked. And there's dozens of them talking about it. And there's going to be there's going to be a discussion on Capitol Hill the day after your rollout, which is going to not only reiterate some of those charges, but introduce new ones against you. Do you want to remind all the women that are watching the Today Show about that? But I'm not very sure.
Because I are one. I can say it, David. A lot of them are clueless. A lot of them. Okay, we got to move on from this, but we got to talk about Liz Clark, the sister I wish I had that I never had. Yes. Who has done stunning work recently on the Washington football team.
Liz
stunning.
Is great. As you know, I'd marry Liz if I weren't married. If I weren't married, I'd marry Liz. But
I'll fight you for her. She's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should we pretend this is about books? And this will be a really wonderful segue to David Mariner.
For show, Tori.
This is about Dolly Parton. And Justin Nick and David Mariner, you don't know this. Dolly Parton is a goddess.
Yes.
And someday we're going to get her on this show. And the best thing she's ever done, in addition to all of her talents and all her success in singing, is started a book club, essentially, where she gives away books to children for free around the world and has given away over 172 million, I think, thus far. She's been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And you say to yourself, how can she not already be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Exactly.
Anyhow, one of the things I learned today reading about this, and I'm going to start doing something on social media, a campaign to get Dolly on this show. But I did not know this. When she broke up with Wagner, you know, she sang with him for a long time. She wrote, I Will Always Love You.
Yeah.
It was the number one song in 1974. And then 20 years later, Whitney Houston did her version of it.
Yes.
Which is still the best-selling single by a woman of all time.
Yeah, really, that's a pretty good song.
Dolly Parton, who's done much for Tennessee. And just wait for the segue, kids. Speaking of Tennessee, someone hanging out in Vanderbilt, David Marinus. Welcome back to the show, David.
Hey, thank you, Tori. And David, I forgot that this is a wine party. I just have cranberry juice.
Come on. Well, you've got time. It's a long show.
Okay.
Boy, but we actually hit your mark, 6-10 after. That's pretty good. So, David, you have been doing this for Vanderbilt. You're in the Department of Political Science, correct?
Yep.
On and off for how many years?
10 years. Every other year I teach here and love it.
Do you drive to and from the DMV?
We actually drove Saturday straight through, 10 and a half hours. Nice. We were planning to stop, but we got to Knoxville at noon. So why stop? You know,
on any of your trips, have you been to Dollywood?
I have not been to Dollywood, but I know all about Dolly. And as a matter of fact, my grandkids here in Nashville, Andrew's kids, which is the reason we love to come here, get those books from Dolly. I mean, she'll do it for anybody who wants to read.
Yeah, and just ask you to pass them on when you're done with them.
Exactly.
Pass them on to a library or a charity or something like that. Okay, you got to go to Dollywood. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And to see what she's done a lot for the entire state, but done for Pigeon Forge is amazing.
Yeah, and Tennessee, I mean, you know, Tennessee is so backwards that for Dolly to even exist here is wonderful.
Yep. Okay. Well, you're existing here with us tonight. I'm so happy because a week or so ago, getting ready for the Painters, which is why you see the chaos behind me.
No. You've got a top room raider there. I mean, I turned my computer around so you wouldn't see the bed.
So I was going through the shelves and I pulled out Rome 1960, your great book about the 1960 Olympics. Which is just wonderful. And I, of course, got completely off schedule because I sat there going through it and I thought, my God, we've got to get David on the show to talk about these current Olympics, because that was, it was about the famous athletes of the time, someone named Cassius Clay, just incredible.
Wilma Rudolph.
Rudolph. But it was about what was going on in the country and the world at the time, which was a lot, certain amount of optimism, Cold War, you know, increased long overdue focus on civil rights in general. But you so put the time and the people in context in that book. So fast forward to 2020, and I followed some of the things we've been talking about on social media. Where are we with the 2020 Beijing Olympics?
Well, you know, I sort of have the same feeling about the Olympics that I do about professional football right now. I really don't like so much of it, but I can't stop sometimes watching it. But I think basically the Olympics are passe. I mean, I think they've sort of run their course. And I, you know, I hate to say that because the idealistic Olympics would be great, but they're so far from that in every possible way. That, you know, I think that what you saw in 1960 was the beginning of the modern world in so many ways. The first drug scandal where a cyclist died from doping. The, you know, Armin Hari, the German sprinter, was illegal taking payments from two shoe companies. You know, all, so many ways, good and bad, the modern world was erupting in 1960. And here we are, you know, 60 years later, and it's sort of the culmination of that in many of the worst possible senses. And the whole motto of the Olympics during much of the 20th century was coined by Avery Brundage, who had ran the place for so long, which is the show must, you know, the games must go on.
Yeah.
And that was sort of a way of saying these are not about politics, which was completely wrong from the beginning, from at least 1936, you know, with the Nazi Olympics all the way through. It's always been politics, and it is again tenfold this year in China.
Yeah. David Aldridge, what do you think?
It's funny you mentioned Avery Brundage. I remember the great Howard Cosell saying as only he could at one point, there was a time for Avery Brundage, the time of William of Orange. that's all you need to say that you know. He was in charge for so long and nothing much has really changed since he was.
You know, he's been the villain in two of my books. I mean, he was in the 1960 Rome book, and then he is again with Thorpe. Because Jim Thorpe, who was stripped of his medals, you know, in 1912, Avery Brundage actually was a competitor of his. He was, believe it or not, you think of Brundage as this fat, cigar-smoking international despot. He was the decathlete.
Was one. Yeah.
He was. But he was also a decathlete. He competed in those Olympics against Jim Thorpe and got clobbered and quit early because he was doing so poorly. And then for most of the rest of his career, he was instrumental in denying Thorpe the medals that he deserved.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that Avery Brundage is an excellent name for a villain, regardless of who he might be as a
fantastic.
Person.
Well, feel free to steal it sometime.
Let's just start using his name in all fiction going forward for bad Avery Brundage. Okay, David Marinus, tell us, because you're going to come back. We're usually off in August, but we might have a special chatter on books in August when you bring out your book on Jim Thorpe. But tell us about it. And from the last time you were on the show, we remember hearing about massive amounts of research you do. And you really sink yourself and immerse yourself in the person, as a member of a family, as a person in history. So tell us why Jim Thorpe, and how's the research going, and how's the book going?
Well, the book is done. I should get it back from the copy editors Wednesday, actually.
Congrats.
It was different, I have to say, you know, as a nonfiction researcher, this was different than every other book I've done. I would have moved to Oklahoma where he grew up you know, but I couldn't because of COVID. I certainly didn't want to live in Oklahoma during that period. And I would have gone to Stockholm, but again, COVID kept me from going there. That's where he won his medals.
Yeah.
I did the same amount of documentary research at, you know, 10 different archives around the country, ranging from the National Archives to the Brundage Archives in Illinois to the wonderful Carlisle Indian School Archives, which is where Thorpe went to school and really gained his fame. So, you know, in my motto had always been go there, wherever there is, for my stories. I had to do a little less of that this time, but I felt as deeply immersed in Thorpe. And I chose him. He's sort of another one in my pantheon, you know, of Lombardi, Clemente, and Thorpe. people who I think were both brilliant in their fields, and also it was a way for me to write about the sociology of something. Lombardi was the mythology of competition and success in American life, what it takes and what it costs. Clemente was, you know, the first great Latino baseball player, someone who had overcome both race and language to become beloved, and was the rare athlete who was growing as a human being as his talents were somewhat diminishing. He was always great until he died. Yeah. And then Thorpe is my way to write both a dramatic athletic story, one of the greatest athletes ever, both an Olympic pentathlete and decathlon gold medalist, the greatest football player of his era, the founder of the first president of the National Football League, and a Major League Baseball player. I mean, who else could do all three of those things?
Anybody come close as an athlete? I remember Bo Jackson. Well,
there are certainly athletes who could do that. I think Bo Jackson could have been similar, but no one else has done it. Deion Sanders, do you think he could have won an Olympic decathlon?
Oh, I don't know. Decathlon's such a unique skill set.
It is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, right. I mean, it's not, he never did it, so I can't say he could have, but I think any athlete at that level, if they trained for that, they could probably be passable at it.
Yes, probably so. But Thorpe was the one who did it all.
Yes.
But that's not why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because it was my chance to write about the Native American experience in the first half of the 20th century through his story, a period when the basic government motto was kill the Indian, save the man, which means get all the Indianness out of these people.
Right.
And so, you know, Thorpe is an example of someone persevering against all of that.
I have so many questions, but we have another author. I'm going to have to let you go, David Marinus. But if you could be really good, like top elite athlete in any sport, what sport would it be?
Baseball.
Yeah, why?
Yeah, that's what I grew up wanting to play shortstop for the Milwaukee Braves.
Yeah,
it's my first sport. I mean, I can't stop watching football, even though I really wish I could stop watching it in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, the Olympics, my favorite thing to watch in the Winter Olympics is the weirdest sport of all. Well, it's not curling, but it's the biathlon. I love watching those skiers going through the beautiful countryside. And then, you know, I don't even like rifles, but I love watching all of that. So
by the way, curling is the official sport of Chatter on Books, David. So
okay,
get on the train.
Well, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, where I'm from, has some top-notch curlers. So I should
exactly. And, you know, probably competing in the co-ed curling, which is fabulous. but somebody talking about the shooting in the Olympics said, how can the United States of all countries not be really good at that?
That's kind of a morbid comment.
Right? Morbid, but funny. Okay, David Marinus, stay healthy.
Okay.
Go to Dollywood. Come back in August or maybe end of July, right before the book comes out.
Anytime, you know, the book will be out all fall, too, so we can do it anytime you want.
Okay, we'll have you back.
Great. Thank
Good
you.
Luck, honey. Thank
Good
you.
See you both.
Bye-bye. Go get a drink.
Okay.
Oh, he's the best. He's absolutely the best.
He's living my life. He's living my life.
Cleaning up the shelves, trying to get ready for painters, and I found Rome 1960. And I swear to God, I had 18 things to do that day, and I sat down for 2 or 3 hours just going, reading it, right? Yeah. Roberto Clemente, Vince Lombardi. And you don't have to care about any one of those people or those topics. And the books are stunning.
Yes.
Absolutely stunning.
It's what I should be doing.
What's that?
It's what I should be doing.
Exactly what you should be doing. There's still time, David.
Can we get Nick on before he just bolts? Because I would have left 20 minutes ago if I were here.
I'm amazed at the combination of sports, books, show. I've listened to your show for a while, but I don't think there's anything else quite like this.
No, there isn't.
It's by design.
We got this is a great segue to Nick Petrie, author of The Runaway, which is fabulous. Lisa Gardner, who you know, wrote a great blurb about your book, was on last week, I kind of lose track, last week, week before. And she sent me a nice email afterwards. And said, no, Carrie Mayer was on last week. Lisa Gardner was a couple weeks ago. But she sent me a nice email afterwards saying, thanks so much fun, you know, love the energy, this and that. And I said, you know, and we probably, David and Claude and I probably skittered around of 18 different things. And she goes, yeah, it's unlike anything else I've ever experienced. And I said, Chatter, it ain't your mother's book club.
Yeah, she's pretty amazing.
I happened to be driving down Connecticut Avenue today, and I passed Politics and Prose, and I swear to God, there was a woman walking in wearing a cat sweater.
There you go.
It's all you need to know. Okay, Nick Petrie, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We are going to talk about this fabulous book, The Runaway. But first, we're going to talk about you. We know you're a writer because you have, are there seven books out now? Is this the seventh?
That's number seven.
It's number seven. But I read in your own bio, not on Wikipedia, but your own bio, that you were a carpenter, a contractor, and a building inspector.
Yes.
All true?
Yes, all true.
So where'd the writing shtick come from?
The writing, I found the writing first. I was the editor of my high school newspaper.
Even David.
Oh, there you go. Great minds. And the fiction came about because I was never any good at the whole, you know, news part. And I didn't know anything about sports then or now. I enjoy a Packer game for sure, because I'm a Wisconsinite. But so I couldn't
like
write.
Aaron Rodgers?
I used to. Let me put it that way. there are a lot of people that I think are former Aaron Rodgers fans.
Yes.
So okay. I don't know. Maybe he'll redeem himself. But so I ended up writing because I could give myself my own assignments and I wasn't good at anything else. I wrote an 8-part soap opera with a very thinly veiled versions of my friends and enemies. So that was my introduction to fiction, and people would. The day the paper came out, people would stop me in the hallway to say, oh, we really like this. And that was, it's like, oh, maybe there's something in this, right? There was a little bit of recognition, an audience.
Was it cathartic to write about your friends and enemies, but in a fictional way?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. I'm still writing about my friends and enemies, really.
I like this. This is good. Right. What does Tony always say? Take care of your friends and punish your enemies. Exactly.
Okay, so we talked about University of Michigan. We'll come back to that in just a little bit. But your first book, The Drifter, so the hero in all of this is Peter Ashe, ex-military, suffering from PTSD, which, you know, serious note, is a big, big, big problem with the military. But your first book, The Drifter, immediately won a bunch of awards. And this is something David Aldridge is going to write a book about, dealing with fame and success. So you write your first book. It's very successful. How did you manage that?
Well, it was successful in the awards department, but it actually was a national bestseller. It would have been on the New York Times list, except 2 weeks before the paperback came out, the New York Times discontinued their mass market paperback list. It's one of those things. But you know, it was not a book like The Girl on the Train or The Firm. It was not one of those books that took off. It was a book that sort of bubbled up from below. And so, you know, I'm not sure I'm suffering from fame and success in the way that some people might think.
Which would you rather have, though, critical acclaim or money?
That's a good question. I guess I'd like more of both. I'm not sure. There's a real answer to that.
The answer is money.
Yeah. Is that the answer?
Yeah. Always. So
someday I'm going to get somebody I know who works at a major publication that understands these lists. And when you really understand how books get on the bestseller list, and I'm not talking about, you know, almost any presidential memoir makes it legitimately, right? But what people do to get their books illegitimately on that list, it's just money. I knew somebody from the DMV, let's just trash people from this area. And this was back in the days when the New York Times list, the Washington Post, the big list kept track of, I think it was 200 or 300 independent bookstores around the country. They actually cared about them. Anyways, this person put his father in a car with huge wads of cash and made him go from bookstore to bookstore to bookstore to bookstore to buy, you know, to go to Milwaukee and say, I'd like 50 copies of Nick Petrie's book, The Runaway. Oh, we only have 10. Okay, I'll buy them. And I want to order 40, and got the book on it. And it's done in a much more sophisticated yet cynical way now. So David Aldridge, critical acclaim or money? If you say critical acclaim, I'm going to resign as your manager. Because I want 10%, baby.
I know. You know, honestly, I mean, money is always nice and it's always good and it's nice to have it. But if I were, I would not get into writing books for money, because I don't think you can make a lot of money writing books, and you probably don't. Most people don't. So I would go because I would like people to like the book. So if that, I guess that's critical acclaim, right?
Yeah. Okay. Here's what you do. Okay, Nick, just bear with us for a minute. This is the, before Tori died, she can get David Aldridge to write a book. One of the reasons you write a book, David, is not because the book will make you a ton of money. The book is the vehicle by which dozens and dozens and dozens of stupid organizations like the Association of Trade Associations pays you $50,000 to come give a speech, and they give away 100 copies of your book.
I know.
10%, baby.
Oh, wait, only 10%?
Yeah. It's really 4% now, Tori. I don't know if you know that.
Suppose not my world. Okay, Nick Petrie, let's talk about The Runaway. And if every time you mention the name of a book on the show, somebody buys a copy. So Excellent. Let's talk about The Runaway. First of all, for those of the three people out there who have not read earlier editions, tell us about Peter Ashe, who he is, why you called him Peter Ashe. I have a theory, but go ahead.
Well, Peter Ashe is a Marine Corps veteran with post-traumatic stress from his days in service that takes the form of claustrophobia. So he can't be inside for more than 15 or 20 minutes before it starts to bubble up into a panic attack. And at the beginning of the series, it's quite acute. It really is. I mean, that's really where he is. He's essentially living either outdoors or in his car. And he's really outside of civilization in a way. And as the books progress, we see Peter get, he's never going to get better, because that's not what really happens with people who have really bad post-traumatic stress, but he does make progress, and he finds his way forward into a life. And he's also somebody who, you know, is a restless person. So this also happens when you have post-traumatic stress, you have trouble sitting still, because then your brain starts to, you know, percolate. So he's always, you know, in a new place, each book is a different city. He's finding a new kind of problem. And this is also something that happens with veterans with post-traumatic stress, is they often try to find atonement by helping others. They sign up for hurricane relief or, you know, so that kind of stuff, where they become police officers, they become firefighters. Part of that's the adrenaline, but part of it is just wanting to, you know, kind of continue to be of use, to continue to have sort of a mission to occupy them. And Peter is very much like that as well, although mostly he's ending up sticking his nose into other people's problems.
Yeah. What caused you to make that the essence of Peter Ashe, of your hero, that has been the subject of these many books?
Well, I was a building inspector. So I'm the guy that you would hire if you're buying a new house and you wanted some to tell you what was wrong with it. And so I would show up around the time of the crash in 2008, 2009, 2010. And I had these clients coming home from overseas, and I'm interested in politics and I read the paper. And, but I realized I hadn't put very much thought into what these folks were doing with their lives after, how they managed to make it through this monumental life-altering experience. And I'm the kind of person who people talk to me. People tell me strange things at the airport, in line at the grocery store. Someone will tell me their marriage is breaking up, or that their grandson is having a child, or, I mean, like, crazy stuff. Uh-huh. Veterans were telling me their stories, like in the basement of this house that I'm inspecting. We're looking at the foundation and the furnace and the plumbing, and they start telling me about what it was like to be overseas, because I wasn't connected to their home life or their service life. So I was a safe person, and they were never going to see me again. Yeah. So I kind of fell in love with these folks, and some of them were physically damaged, and some of them, you know, you could just sort of tell we're just not right. And so that to me was a very interesting kind of character, and the idea of how do you recover from such a profound experience? So that's kind of where the whole series came from.
Yeah. Okay. So Peter Ashe, this troubled soul, he just has a nose for finding trouble, and then he feels like he has to fix that. Is that how he deals with his demons? Is that part of addressing his demons?
Absolutely.
Helping other people and trying to help them out of trouble?
but helping other people out of trouble. And also, you know, he is like many vets, he's also kind of an adrenaline junkie. And so it's a way to sort of dip his toe back into that life that, you know, he hates and he loves. The dirty secret of war is that it's really exciting. And that you get to blow stuff up and your adrenaline, you know, fires up. And it's a, you know, people have written for centuries about how war makes you feel alive. And so that is also part of this. The whole series is also kind of a meditation on war and violence.
Yeah. So many years ago when I worked at the Pentagon, and, you know, they run to the sounds of the guns, right? And it's well known in the military. And years ago, when we were anticipating this crazy thing or contemplating this crazy thing about putting a lot of the media, the pointy end of the spear, as they say, started the Iraq War, we're having briefings with bureau chiefs and reporters and everybody under the sun, and really senior military who had seen everything and done everything said, look, one of the things that could happen is when you put them at the point of the spear, you're going to have some of these media are going to want to, you know, run to the sound of the guns. They're going to want to be out there in incredibly dangerous situations. Remarkable number of the correspondents would throw up their hands, go, yeah, not me. No, thank you. Don't need to run to the sound of the guns. Okay, so I want you to give us the CNN headlines version of the plot of this story. And one of the things that's unique about this story is that it's almost all the others, it's seen through the eyes and ears and experiences of Peter. This introduces Helene, and you experience a lot of the story without giving too much away through Helene. So give us the CNN headlines version of the plot, and then why Helene gets this inflated role.
Well, Helene is, when we meet her, she is a nighttime gas station clerk in rural Montana. And she is the one of only two people left in this dying town. The other person is her boss, who's also her landlord, who's also a deputy sheriff named Bogalusa. And she's 18 years old, and he has made it clear that he wants something out of her that she is unwilling to give. And she realizes that the clock is ticking and she needs to get out of there before things get good, very bad for her. And she, someone shows up in the middle of the night to gas up his truck and continue west. And he's nice to her. And there's not a lot of people who are nice to Helene.
And he's good looking.
Which never hurts.
A little Brad Pittish for the Netflix series.
Could be, yeah. Brad Pitt can have whatever role he wants, as far as
I had Sam Elliott in my head as Roy.
A younger Sam Elliott.
Okay.
Yeah. But so she follows him out to the pump and says, you know, she realizes this is her only opportunity to get out of this problem. And she says, please take me with you. And he says, well, where do you want to go? And she says, anywhere but here. So she hops in his truck and drives away with him. And of course, she thinks she's going off to a place of relative safety. And because this is a thriller, you know, things, of course, go downhill from there for her. So that's sort of the Helene storyline. That's where we meet Helene. We meet her again, essentially, through Peter's eyes, when Peter is driving through rural Nebraska and meets a young woman whose car is broken down. She's enormously pregnant and needs a lift. And she says, oh, by the way, I'm on the run from my husband, who is a very, very bad man. So we have these two timelines that tick along, we alternate back and forth. I'm not sure that's exactly the CNN headlines. That might be a bit long for CNN, but
no, that's good. That's good. But here's a question, because I think, okay, first of all, a lot of women reading this book, Nick, I'm just going to have to tell you, every time you referred to her as enormously pregnant or, you know, hugely pregnant, we're like, really, really? You think we don't know that? We don't think that we don't know that's what we look like at 9.5 months. I'm just saying.
That's Peter's point of view. But I also this has been vetted by my wife, who is also has been pregnant, and my agent and my editor who my agent's been pregnant. I'm not sure about my editor.
Yeah, well, they have to sleep with you and work for you, Nick. I don't. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but you don't know the women in my life. They do not give an inch. They do not suffer a moment of anything out of me. So.
Okay, but so people who read all of your books, I know many people listening to the show have, Peter Ashe was it, and we saw the story and we experienced the thrills and spills through him. What caused you, and I think you think a lot about your writing, I want to hear about that, what caused you to say, we're going to see this through her eyes and ears and experience and huge belly, quote unquote, as much as his?
Well, I did not think she would have such a large role. I write.
Was it her belly? Was that it?
No, that was not it. It was her voice. It was really, she just sort of started talking. And I kind of thought, okay, she's going to be sort of the client character, right? In a PI novel, there's always the client character, right? Yeah. And I thought that would be her role. But she just kept showing up. And I would write a little bit of Helene, and then I would do the Peter's part. And then Helene would just sort of tap me on the shoulder and say, I'm sorry, no, I need to tell you some more stuff. This is kind of how I work, although it's never happened to me in quite this way.
Talk about that, because I've read a little bit about this, but talk about your process of writing, which is pretty
interesting. Well, I'm what's called in the business a pantser. So I write by the seat of my pants. I do not start with a plan or an outline. And I just kind of feel my way forward. And typically I'm looking for, sort of a circumstance. I'm looking for something to get the ball rolling for me. And then at a certain point, it sort of catches fire. And I just kind of write forward into the story from there. And this book I wrote the first Helene chapters. And then I thought, I can't possibly make this work for a Peter Ash novel. She's super compelling. I really like the problems I've given her. But I don't know how I can make this, sort of turn into this book that my publisher has contracted with me to write. So then I wrote another beginning to a different kind of story, and it was just nowhere near as good. And so then I wrote yet another beginning, which was even worse. And I finally just, I finally said to Margaret, I'm leaving. And I threw some camping gear in our ancient minivan, and I drove to Nebraska.
You pulled a Peter Ash.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm a big believer in sort of the meditation of the road. So I've done a lot of camping and a lot of driving. And in part, I think, and I don't know if this works for you either, Tori and David, but there's so much chatter in my head between social media and checking the newspaper, checking my email 6 times a day, that there's something really wonderful about basically getting in the car and going. And I have a rule, which is once I'm out of the range of my local public radio station, I can't turn on the radio. And the
good
book,
rule. Very good rule.
And the car is so old that it doesn't connect to my phone. So I just, first I sort of go crazy, and then I just sort of remember who I actually am, and I sort of settle in. And it was on that drive and camping in Iowa and Nebraska that I sort of figured out how this was all gonna kind of come together. So it's a strange process, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. It's not efficient. It's not pretty. But it's also the only way I know how to work.
It's amazing how many different versions of, okay, David Aldridge, current life, doing the kind of work you're doing in future, soon to be future life when you're writing your first book. Pantser? Not a pantser.
No, total pantser. Total. Yeah. I'm not near smart enough to have an outline for anything.
No, you're right.
Start with one nugget of information. Look, I'm a builder, I guess. I'll take one piece of information that I discover and, kind of run with that and go through it and all the permutations of it and find 10 other things based on that one thing and then 10 other things based on those 10 things. And by then you've got something. That's kind of how I operate.
It's a much more elegant way to describe your process to call yourself a builder than to call yourself a pantser. So I'm going to start using that.
Please, Thank still, you, please, I sir, appreciate please. That. With my no, compliments.
That's a writer thing. We've had so many people on the show, Nick, many Iowa Writers Workshop, this and that, whatever, and they describe themselves as that. But remember Rebecca Sachs, David and Claude, City of 1,000 Gates.
Incredible. Oh, yes, with the paper and everything.
She talked about, and if she had pictures of her apartment in which there are multiple strings around the apartment and index cards and larger pieces of paper. And it got down to she would a sentence per index card. And then she would look at it and go, no, it's got to be your, it's stunning. Absolutely stunning.
That's John McPhee's process. The nonfiction writer is he basically builds it with business cards or with 3x5 cards, which just boggles my mind.
Ken Follett uses a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Use an Excel spreadsheet online. Ken, who's got 2 great puppies, by the way, if anybody wants to follow him on social media, Excel spreadsheet, because he has so many characters, and among other things, he wants to keep meticulous care of who does what when and make sure there are no inconsistencies and contradictions and things like that, but an Excel spreadsheet. And I think there's some app now that writers can use. to help them actually build the book. David, maybe that's your birthday present, honey.
You know, it's funny, the writers groups and writers classes talk about finding your voice, that is the sort of the thing that a writer needs to do. And I, for me, I think it's really about finding your process. It's finding the way that you work, that you can both get the project done and do it well, and then do the next project and the project after that. And I'm really interested in this process stuff. And whenever I'm with another writer, these are the things I want to know, is how do you work and what can I steal from you that might work for me? I love those conversations.
Okay. So it's whatever you're doing, your pantsing routine, if I can make that word up, seems to be working for you. You actually think you would do something differently? Do you think it would help?
You know, I've tried. My fifth book sort of showed up in a way that had never showed up, that no other book had showed up. It takes place in Iceland. Mm-hmm. And I was on a backpacking trip with my son, and we were in the airport on the way home, and the whole book showed up in my head intact for about 20 minutes. And so I scribbled as fast as I could. I pulled out my little notebook and I scribbled and scribbled, and then it disappeared. And all I had were these notes. And I thought, oh, I have this blueprint, right? So this is, maybe I can become an outliner. And so I started working in that way, and that's the book. So I'm on my publishing cycle is a book every year. Uh-huh. And that's the book that was 8 months late. Hmm. So I guess I'm trying to sort of lean into my process and to refine it, but not to try to do anything too radically different.
Yeah, because you've got something that's so organically good. If you try to put too much process on top of it, right now we've lost the three listeners that we had. Patty's like gone out for an early morning drink because she didn't have to stay up in LA.
There's a question.
Okay. Let's get back to The Runaway. It bordered lots of violence, borderline dark. At any point, Nick, did you think this might be too much? Did some of those voices in your head or people who love and care for you say, ooh, maybe a little too much?
You know, there are a couple of friends and family members who have read this and be like, wow, I didn't know you kind of had that in you. And I didn't either. Some books are more fun to write than others. And the darker aspects of this book definitely made it more challenging. Hmm. There are other books that have really felt like, you know, bounding through a meadow with a puppy kind of thing. And that was not what this book was.
No. What caused you to take this turn on this one? Or was it Helene speaking to you?
It was Helene speaking to me. She really set the course. And what I knew was going to happen between her and Roy, and realizing that I couldn't just gloss over it, that I needed to sort of show the steps along the way. Uh-huh. But it's not, you know, the other thing that's happening with this book, though, right, is we're seeing how her life gets progressively worse and worse and worse. But we're also seeing her resilience and her determination to you know, find her way out of this and to change her life. And to me, that's sort of the flip side of that coin. Was it Lisa Gardner who on your show was talking about how she's never really sure what a book is really about until it's done?
Yeah.
For me, it's very much the same way. And I realized that in a way, this book is kind of about my experience of COVID and quarantine, right? It's two people trapped in a house, right? That's my wife and I. Mm-hmm. The dynamic is very different, but it's hard to escape each other. You know, and this was really this was pre-vaccine. This was the height of all the worst stuff. And I got to the end of it and I started thinking about the kind of conversations I was going to have when the publication was going to happen. And I kind of realized that was the itch I was trying to scratch internally. Right.
Right. How much of this did you share with your wife before you sent it to publication?
She sees it at a couple of times, typically prior to sending it off to my agent and my editor. So she actually read the first Helene stuff. And I said, am I crazy? Is this like, you know, and she said, no, this is, I want to know what happens to her. I'm riveted. Just keep going. Right. And there's always a point with every book. And actually I've just done it with the one I'm working on now, where I really have, I'm full of doubt, and I've got a big chunk of work. I've got 10 or 20,000 words. And I'm like, what do I actually have? And I can't you know, I've been through it a couple of times. I can't really see it anymore. I'm not quite sure where it's going to go. And I just print it out and I hand it to Margaret and I say, is this any good? Mm-hmm. And like with this one, I gave her actually two separate pieces and she said, this is bad. This is good. Write that one. And so, because I have learned from experience that Margaret knows everything, I just did what she tells me.
Good for you. David, do you ever share your stuff early on with your SO?
Yeah. No. I'm very, I am so selfish.
Does she comment writing. On your stuff ever?
Sometimes, you know, but.
Good or bad or all the above?
I mean, usually good, but I am in my own head when I'm writing. I can count on one hand the number of times I've asked somebody to look at something I've written before I write it. I can't do it. It's mine. I'm very selfish about it. It's my voice. It's my head. I don't think anybody can tell me what I'm thinking about, whatever it is I'm writing about. And I just, it's not a good trait of mine.
Well, it's kind of fragile, right?
Yeah.
When you're, you know, the line I used with my editor is it's like building a sandcastle. And the slightest wave will topple the whole thing over.
Yes.
I mean,
it
really is it's all in my head.
Yeah.
So it's a very fragile process. I sympathize.
Okay. I'll take that analogy one step further, Nick. 1,000 years ago. Okay. This is a perfect example, David. Lipstick on the Pig. One of the worst written. Completely.
Stop it.
Thank you.
Stop it. Fine. Stop it.
No,
I have read way worse.
David, it gave me 30 speeches. At ridiculous sums, right? So let's just stop there. But one of the worst written, completely unedited, Dominic Anfuso, thank you very much, ever. And I think I was too much of a chicken to show it to my husband before they said to me, no more changes, you know, it's going. And I gave it to Brian, my husband, to read, and he fell asleep reading it. That was 16 years ago, it's a sore spot that will never be overcome. That was washed away, that we would never go to the beach again because it raises.
He was really tired. He was very tired.
He was just tired. He was busy.
Okay, Nick Petrie, author of The Runaway and many other wonderful books. Here's the get out of this question. Here's the get you out with this question. What's the pinnacle of success for you with this book? What do you want readers doing, thinking, experiencing when they read The Runaway or any of your great Peter Rasch books?
Well, my goal, I mean, I don't think of what I write of as commercial fiction. For me, I'm writing, I don't know, something more complicated than that. But what I want for my readers is to get lost. I want you to sit down for 15 minutes and look up 3 hours later, right? I get emails and online posts from people who are saying, I read your book in the 24 hour period, right? Like that to me is if you have to put down everything to finish this book, that is the highest compliment that I can get as a writer.
Excellent. That's a great accomplishment. Okay. It's a wonderful book. Everyone should go buy it at their favorite independent bookstore. Nick, thank you so much. Hope you come back.
I would love to. This is great. I think you guys do a great thing. And I love the chat part. I love how fast you guys are.
Yeah. Like, beer and the wine helps. That's all.
Like a really bad Tracy Hepburn movie. It's just like the worst one, like Desk Set, the worst one that they did. That's us.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, everybody. Let's see, a little bit of housekeeping. Claude, can you remind people about Patreon?
This would be absolutely real- all kinds of exclusive audio pre-show, post-show, also the 60 seconds more segment with Nick that we just did. You didn't hear it if you're not a Patreon member. That's the Patreon exclusive. Also, Patty and Rob are joining us tonight. Patty says she loves Lipstick on a Pig and said that she met Harbaugh's dad at Western Kentucky. See, that kind of stuff is what you get. Yeah. When you're a Patreon member. Yeah. You get to come on and watch the show live and stuff like that. Patreon.com/chatteronbook. Sign up today.
Awesome. Thank you. Everybody follow us, download us, write nice reviews. If you write a nice review on Apple, we will read it. And we are back next week with, I'm very excited about the Sadiqa Johnson, who has this incredible book called A Yellow Wife, a novel. It is fantastic. Claude, thank you for making things happen. David Aldridge, as ever. David Marinus, long gone, but we love you. Nick, thank you so much.
And thank you so much.
Stays well. Thank you for listening, and we will see you soon. And we're out.